Good afternoon, everybody, and again, thanks for joining us. This is Tim Cosgrove, again, along with Nathaniel John Henry, and we work here on the public policy and advocacy piece in Columbus, and thought it would be helpful if we started this by giving a little bit of background in terms of where we are, kind of the strategy behind the legislative calendar, and talking a little bit about some of the practical realities that we're all going to face as we come out of the other end of this. First, obviously, this is unprecedented. We've heard that probably too much over the last 2 weeks, but it in fact is unprecedented. And overall, I think the state policymakers are getting high marks for the decisions that they're making, but they also recognize that this is uncharted territory, and they are trying to, if you will, figure this out as they go. So that's why there have been so many moving targets with respect to dates on suspension of certain activities and those types of things. And I suspect that they will continue to move. Now, obviously, the governor's stay-in-place order was instituted earlier this week and is set to be in place until April 6th. Also, obviously, the suspension of schools is set to expire at the end of next week. I fully anticipate, based on the briefings that they're getting on the healthcare side of this, that we can expect that those will both be extended. Although I will say that I believe there's a growing recognition within state government and within the administration that the economic consequences of this are going to have long-term ramifications as well. So they have really tried, I think, to balance that as best they can. And in fact, if you look at Ohio's stay-in-place order, it tends to be a little bit more flexible, I think, than most of the other states have done, whether or not in terms of determining what are essential businesses and those types of questions. So in that regard, the governor laid out a framework in the last week in terms of what he was requesting of the legislature. And obviously, we're going to talk about 197 here in a couple of minutes. But what the governor had asked in the context of this bill is that the legislature focus on those things that were critical in terms of timing, both in respect to responding to the public health crisis, but also to respond to some critical governmental function issues that needed to be addressed in the short term. And that was really the intent behind 197. So you had things like open meetings, obviously, which we'll talk about, the elections and those types of questions that they wanted to resolve in this process. There is an expectation, and there's a recognition, I should say, that much more is going to have to be done. There are all types of issues that arise from really the suspension of commerce and government for this period of time that need to be dealt with. This was just the first crack at it. And there will be a second round. And I think the expectation is that the legislature is likely to return in a week or two to take another cut at some of these issues. So we should expect that there will be a list compiled. And as we think through and look to the future, it's important that we recognize that there are going to be these future opportunities. And I also would expect that when we're on the other side of the public health crisis, whether that's at the end of May or June, that the legislature is going to be significantly more busy than it had been anticipated because of all the issues they're going to have to be confronted as a result of this. And finally, and this is something that you all know painfully well, but one of the issues that the state is going to have to deal with is revenues. As the state over the past decade, really primarily under the Kasich administration, really restructured our tax code and shifted the emphasis from more of a balance on the income tax and the sales tax. The result of the shift is that the state is more reliant on the sales tax now than it has ever been, or certainly within modern history. So because of the way this economic shutdown has occurred, there is obviously an expectation that the state revenues are going to decrease dramatically. so that it is likely that the state will have to revisit the current budget before the end of the biennium, or perhaps even before the end of the first year of the biennium. There is roughly about $2.7 billion in the rainy day fund, which sounds like a lot of money, but I would anticipate that that will be spent relatively quickly. And there will also be, as we go through this, a series of issues dealing with property taxes and property tax payments, because I think there's an expectation that the default rates are going to increase. So there are going to be all types of issues like that that are going to be confronted and dealt with over the course of the next several months. So with that, I think it probably makes sense for me. I don't know if Nathaniel, if you wanted to add anything, or if we just go into the meat of House Bill 197.
I think that's great, Tim, and I'll stick around with you to answer questions after we go through the meat of 197.
Thank you.
So, hi, everyone. This is Emily Spivak from the Labor and Employment team here at Squire. I'm going to start walking through several components of 197 that particularly impact schools. And then I know some of my public finance colleagues are going to take a deeper dive into some other components. So one of the major pieces that was addressed for schools in 197 has to do with evaluations. So looking mostly at teacher evaluations, but this also has impact on administrative evaluations. One thing the legislature did was prohibit the use of value-added data from the 1920 school year for teacher evaluations. So value-added data from this year is to have no impact on evaluations or contract decisions. On one hand, that's helpful because obviously we don't have good end-of-the-year value-added data, particularly as we're going to talk about, because state assessments have been canceled. But it does raise the question of whether any teacher evaluation can be completed, because most collective bargaining agreements require the consideration of value-added data. So if your collective bargaining agreement for teachers simply makes reference to whatever the state law is, doesn't get into any detail, there's still the possibility that you could comply with the CBA and complete an evaluation, although there are some more variables I'll talk about in a minute. But if your CBA specifically makes reference to value-added data, there would be some concern that no teacher evaluations are possible this year without the data from this year. That would be something to discuss with your teachers' union to see what their position would be on that. The next thing the legislature did in terms of evaluations was to allow the Department of Education to waive deadlines. Again, this seems helpful. So ODE now has the ability to waive evaluation deadlines. So coming up on that May 1 evaluation deadline for teachers, the May 10 summative submission deadline also for teachers, ODE has the option to waive those, as well as the June 1 notice date for non-renewal. And that's the notice date for non-renewal for all of your employees. So that could have broader implications. ODE now also has the option to waive the July 1 deadline to adopt OTES 2.0. So if ODE chooses to do that, your boards would have the option not to adopt new policies this summer. Having said all of that, again, your CBAs, particularly your teacher's contract, may have these dates baked in. So even if ODE acts to extend the deadline, if your teacher's contract calls for the final observation by May 1, ODE's action doesn't change that. And so that is, again, something you would need to talk to your teachers' unions about. There is the possibility, we'll talk about bargaining in a minute, that the waiver of the OTES 2.0 deadline would allow carryover of some existing contracts that otherwise would not have been able to carry over. But again, I'll touch on that in a minute. So then we get to the meat of what the legislature did with evaluations. What they essentially said was that evaluation requirements may be waived for this year. So the board can decide not to evaluate employees this year, and that would be fine. However, you want to be cautious, because if your district chooses not to do evaluations, then you will not be able to non-renew any employees. So keep in mind, as you're making this decision, you need to look for employees who are about to roll over and do a continuing contract if you don't take further action. You can look at the option for extended limited contracts in certain circumstances. Some folks will be eligible, some won't. But you do want to look carefully at who's going to be impacted if you waive evaluations for this year. Finally, if the district actually did complete a full evaluation prior to the school closures, you can proceed with non-renewal, again with the caveat that value-added data has been removed from the calculation. And so you need to look at your CBAs and see how that might impact the evaluation process. There is permissive language in the statute to meet with the union and agree to complete evaluations for this year. You can talk about doing remote evaluations for teachers who are conducting online classes, that sort of thing. Anecdotally, so far, we are seeing unions being very resistant to those ideas. So the options may be limited in that respect. As Tim mentioned, this isn't the last. We think the legislature will look at some of these issues. There is always the possibility that evaluation would be back, or that non-renewal could somehow come back on the radar, but this is at least the first pass through. And so you need to consider carefully what's going to happen with the May deadlines, the June deadlines, and those folks who could automatically roll over to new contracts next year. The legislature also did a lot in terms of student completion of credits, assessments, and ability to graduate in this legislation. Importantly, the legislature determined that instruction students are receiving online during this closure can count toward graduation. Keep in mind, though, that your board must take action to approve that. Okay, so that's a piece where each individual board is going to need to act to implement what House Bill 197 allows. Squire is working on template resolutions for that. But you should consult with counsel to make sure you get that done. Of course, we've already mentioned that districts do not need to administer state assessments this year. ODE will still have to count students in your enrollment for next year, even if they didn't take the assessment. So that's helpful. And the third grade reading guarantee, there's essentially a pass this year. If the principal and the reading teacher agree that a student is reading below grade level and isn't prepared to be promoted to fourth grade, that student can still be retained, but we don't have the same strict parameters we would in a normal school year. The legislature did put in place steps so that students on track to graduate as of the closure order may still graduate. So we're essentially looking at the end of the third quarter or so for most of you. As long as the student was still on track to graduate, they can graduate. The superintendent or CEO of the district can waive requirements that the board has put in place to the extent the board requires anything beyond the state minimums for graduation. Do keep in mind there's a requirement built in here that for students who need to be on site to complete vocational or other programs, the district may need to be open over the summer for students to complete those programs. And there's also language baked into 197 addressing College Credit Plus, it's permissive, not mandatory. So the Department of Ed is supposed to work with the Chancellor of Higher Education to try and make those credits work. We don't know at this point what the colleges and universities are going to accept for those students. 197 also addresses certain licensure issues. But it does so in a little bit of a confusing way. Special ed teachers and special ed service providers get, it seems, special dispensation here. Their licenses are extended even if they would otherwise be expiring. At least their licenses with their individual boards. It is not clear that their ODE licenses are impacted here. And the statute makes specific reference to special education teachers and service providers. It does not reference general education teachers or administrator licenses. So it seems those types of licenses, as well as student activity permits, aid permits, those sorts of things were not addressed here. The law now does allow special ed services to be provided remotely, which is helpful. And anyone who is waiting to take an ODE exam this year to get licensed gets a one-year provisional license for next year. In terms of special education, as I mentioned, now those services can be provided remotely. And the other thing 197 did is make clear that anyone currently on a John Peterson scholarship, one of the other special education scholarships for this school year, will get to continue on it for next school year. And of course, you all know there won't be report cards for districts this year, although ODE is still supposed to collect as much data as they can and release it. So those are the labor, employment, and student side issues that came out of 197. Some other questions and issues we're seeing along those lines have to do with paying employees during these closures. Revised Code Section 3319.081 requires all non-teaching employees be paid for their time lost when the schools in which they are employed are closed due to an epidemic. So your classified staff must continue to be paid during this time. Your teaching staff is also being paid under their contract. That's a little bit easier to justify to the public because your teachers are teaching remotely. But your classified staff, whether they are coming into work, working from home, or just assigned to home, they have to be paid under 3319.081. They should be paid their regular rate of pay, not overtime, but keep in mind your contract may require something else there. The statute only requires the regular rate of pay. Under the governor's orders, all school employees are subject to being called into work at the superintendent's discretion. So essentially, you are paying for the employee's availability here. Keep an eye on your CBAs. Watch for places you may need to bargain during this time. So as I mentioned, your calamity day sections may call for overtime. We're seeing new legislation at the federal level that requires additional types of leave. Make sure you're giving notice to your unions about any new policies in effect there. Check your contract for language that would allow management to take action in the event of emergency circumstances, things like that. And then also one piece that could be particularly useful is latitude in assigning employees across classifications if need be. One thing we're seeing a lot is you may not need your one-on-one aides acting as one-on-one aides now, but they may be really helpful to have in the kitchen making breakfast and lunch if you try to get that food out the door to your students. So look at your options for assigning across classifications and talk with your unions about that. As I mentioned, we've seen legislation at the federal level The new leave provisions do apply to public schools in Ohio, but it is probably less of an immediate issue for all of you because of 3319081 and the fact that your classified folks, really, and your certified folks are still being paid through all of this. But for now, you do want to make sure you get the poster up in your buildings, get it out to staff, put it on your website. Wherever you put your standard employee notices, make sure it's there. The stay-at-home order calls for all public entities to designate their essential functions and their essential employees. Your superintendent can do that with the board ratifying it later, but we do believe board action is required on that. It would be helpful to make sure the resolution allows the superintendent to adjust the list as necessary, because this is a rapidly changing situation, as we all know. Someone who doesn't seem essential today may be very essential tomorrow, and we don't want your board to have to come together every time to adjust that list. And finally, on the employee side, there's also the issue of supplemental contracts, particularly now for spring sports. Give consideration to whether you want to prorate those contracts. The board can act on that to say they've essentially been canceled because of the governor's order, but do look at how much of the work has already been performed. Can any of the work be performed remotely? And make prorating decisions based on that. Finally, another thing we're seeing, a lot of you are donating personal protective equipment and other materials to hospitals and emergency services organizations. Keep in mind that under normal circumstances, there are pretty strict parameters on to whom and when a Board of Education can make a donation. Boards can take action to authorize their superintendents to donate this type of material. That action can be retroactive. Keep in mind, while there is some risk here because of the rules surrounding donations, we believe it's highly unlikely that the Auditor of State is going to take issue with these types of donations, but we do think it is helpful to have your board acting explicitly to approve it and to note the public interest that is served by the donation. And I will stop there to turn it over to my public finance colleagues.
Thank you, Emily. Good afternoon. I'm Rick Maniloff. I'm on the public finance team at Squire Patton Boggs. Thank you, Tim and Emily, for your reports and analysis thus far. I'll be primarily highlighting, as has been mentioned, the Sunshine Law and also election provisions of House Bill 197, which I understand, I didn't see it live, but I understand the governor signed House Bill 197 over the back of his press conference today. So first off, on meetings, House Bill 197 permits meetings to be held electronically, could be by teleconference, which I understand was debated early on, could be by video conference and any other similar electronic technology. School districts have already been rolling this out on platforms like Zoom, Google Meet, Skype, and others. Best practices are starting to develop quickly, and what we intend to do at Squire is to collect best practices in one place on a dedicated web page so that everybody can share such information. I would also note that OASBO's Collaborate space is a fantastic place to share this kind of best practice information. Some important points on meetings, both legal and practical. First, board members or committee members, and remember that board committees are, quote, public bodies, end quote, subject to the Sunshine Law. those members who are electronically linked to a meeting, number one, are considered present at the meeting, number two, can vote, and number three, are to be counted for purposes of establishing a quorum. And if a resolution or any other formal action is approved at a virtual meeting, it has the same effect as if the action had been taken at an in-person meeting. As a practical note, and it's important legally as well, make sure that the board members can be heard, that board members can hear each other, and that the public can hear the discussion and observe the discussion and deliberation. More on that in a moment. Before going live with your first electronic meeting, you might well want to kick the tires and give the electronic platform a test ride to work out any bugs. I know several school districts that are doing that even now. On notice, House Bill 197 has special provisions relating to notice of electronic meetings, and we're already giving advice on these kinds of notices, including just an hour ago. Some important points here, 24 hours notice must be given A, to the public, and B, to the media that have requested notification of a meeting. And the notice that is given must be by, quote, reasonable methods by which any person may determine the time, location, and the manner by which the meeting will be conducted. So you have to talk about whether it's going to be on Google Meet or Skype or on a YouTube live stream or what. So the manner that it'll be conducted is important to be included in the notice. On access, House Bill 197 requires public access that is, quote, commensurate, and that's going to be the interpretive term here, with the method in which the meeting is being conducted. The legislation itself includes non-exhaustive examples like live streaming over the internet, local radio, television, cable, public access channels, call-in information for a teleconference. One school district treasurer I was talking to today is going to be the person in charge of running a virtual meeting using Google Meets. That's going to be live streamed on YouTube, I understand, with a way for the public to ask questions and provide comments on the YouTube platform, and I believe by other means as well. And those questions and comments are going to be fielded by the assistant superintendent during the meeting. At least that's my understanding of the game plan. And so so one more skill for our CFO friends to learn, I guess, electronic meeting organizer, one more hat for our CFO friends to wear. As mentioned before, it's key that the public can observe and hear the discussions and deliberations that are going on at the meeting. And so when we're talking about access, that is critical. On participation, this isn't necessarily a matter of state law, but many board policies talk about limited public participation in board meetings and committee meetings. So you should take a good look at your board policies on that as you are determining the means and methods for your meetings. As a practical matter, on a teleconference, it'll be important to have board members announce themselves so that the public knows who is speaking. Roll call votes will also be important in such a context. I think most school boards these days take formal votes by roll call anyway, but that will be all the more important in the context of a teleconference. On the effective time period of these particular provisions that I've been discussing relating to the Sunshine Law, they are effective only during the period of emergency that was declared on March 9, but not later than December 1, 2020, even if the period of emergency extends beyond that, of course, unless the legislature takes further action. I guess as a side comment, I would say that depending upon how all this goes, it's not impossible to imagine that the new technologies that we are and will be using might eventually inch their way into the permanent laws of the land. People are already realizing that these new technologies aren't as hard to use as one might think. Speaking personally, it's not as scary as I once thought, and they work rather well. And so we might see that, like I said, inching their way into the permanent laws of the land. Moving on to the primary election, House Bill 197 extends quote, absent voting, end quote, relating to the March 17 election through April 28. People taking advantage of this needed to have been registered to vote in Ohio as of February 18. Ballots that are postmarked by April 27 and that are received at the appropriate Board of Elections by May 8 will be counted. The post-election deadlines for actions to be performed by boards of election and by the Secretary of State will follow those deadlines already in the statutes as applied to the March 17 election plus 42 days. That's the difference between March 17 and April 28. And Tim, I know that you were following up with the Secretary of State's office on a few further procedural points. I'm not sure if you have any information on that yet to report. Do you by chance?
Actually, there is a, thanks, Rick. There is a call taking place with the Secretary of State and Board of Elections officials at 3 o'clock today. Right now, the plan is that they will, that they will release unofficial election results at 7:30. They will treat it like an election day, and they will release unofficial results at that time.
Okay. Thanks, Tim. And I believe the state has appropriated, I think, Tim, $7 million or something like that to implement these absent voting provisions. I guess with that, I could just highlight a few other points on Ed Choice. The simple message there is that the Ed Choice designated buildings for next year, 2020/21, are going to be limited to those previously eligible for the 1920. School year, and the 60-day application period for the 2021 scholarships begins on April 1. And so I know that the people have been following that very closely, and I do believe that BASA, OSBA, and OASBO has a call coming up at 4, where I am sure that that topic will be a headliner. Another note, with people working from home, do you withhold and remit on wages with respect to the district's location or the location of the employee's home? House Bill 197 answers that. You can continue withholding and remitting on wages paid the municipal income taxes for the municipality in which your school district is located rather than the municipalities in which your employees reside and perform services, but that's just during the period covered by the executive order, plus 30 days after that. And I know many of the people on this call are in charge of that, so I wanted to raise that bullet point. I guess with that, Crystal, that would conclude my remarks on this call.
Great. Thanks, Rick. Just a reminder to anybody that called in after you know, right after three to ask any questions. To unmute yourself, you'll just need to press #1. Thank
Michelle,
you.
Or excuse me, Crystal, if I could add one thing. This is Tim Cosgrove. Another very
Certainly.
Important piece of this or provision in this legislation has to do with the voucher program, which I know many districts were extremely focused on and concerned about. That program has essentially been frozen in place as it exists in the 1920 school year. And that so there's been a moratorium. So the changes that were initially scheduled to take effect February 1, then the deadline was kicked till April 1st. All that has been put on hold so that we should not anticipate changes to the program in the 2021 school year. So I don't know if there are questions. Please have at it. Again, hit #1 and feel free to ask your question.
Yes, this is Fred Bolden, Solon City Schools. I had a couple of questions regarding the contract renewals and the actions that were taking place for things dealing with that. You had mentioned that if they don't get their evaluation, being able to be non-renewed comes into a question. So do we have options to non-renew teachers that if our union doesn't agree to remote evaluations?
That's kind of an open question at this point. I think looking at the strict language in the statute, no. And that's a real problem. That is one reason I hope that this will come back up for the legislature, because as it stands now, they fixed half your problem. Half your problem was you couldn't finish evaluations you were obligated to do, and they fixed that for you. They said you don't have to do them. And that's all well and good for the majority of your staff. But for those folks who you're looking at non-renewing, I don't see a clear path to non-renewal here in the teacher context where you haven't concluded, where you haven't already done three formal observations prior to school closing. I think the fact that value-added data can't be used is another complicating factor there.
So I guess similarly, the next question I have is if we have teachers that have applied for continuing contracts, didn't get their three evaluations for those continuing contracts, do they default to being awarded a continuing contract, or can we push those continuing contract applications to the following year because they didn't get their evaluations?
I think you should look at the possibility of an extended limited contract. We have to do that on a case-by-case basis, just looking at the particulars of each teacher, but that can be a very useful tool. The problem is you can only use it once. So if you had someone on an extended limited this year, you're not going to be able to do that again for next year. You'd have to make an up or down decision on the continuing contract. And those are the people I'm most concerned about, the people who are about to roll over onto a continuing contract unless the board takes action otherwise. So you do, in many cases, you do have the option for an extended limited contract, and that's something you should talk with your board attorneys about. For the cases that you do have.
Hi, this is Dan Wilson, Mentor Schools. Two questions. One, Emily, is it possible you could give us a sample board resolution as it relates to the public participation or waiving board policy or suspending board policy and not allowing public participation?
Yes, and let me just say, for those of you who have NEOLA policies, NEOLA policy 0169.1 says public participation shall be permitted only as indicated on the order of business in the agenda or at the discretion of the presiding officer. If your board has not modified the NEOLA language your board president has the authority to dispense with the public participation. If your board has modified the policy, you know, you'll need to look at that more closely. OSBA policy, it's policy BDDH or policy KD, just says the section on the agenda for public participation shall be indicated. There's a lot less wiggle room there. So, Dan, yes, the short answer is we can certainly provide a template board resolution. For those of you with NEOLA policies, you may not need one. If you've got OSBA policy.
All right. And secondarily, you mentioned that we should get board approval on items we've donated to the hospital or fire department or other public agencies. Is there a draft template you could share with us for that purpose?
Yes.
And then going forward, I think I understood you to say that board resolution could designate the superintendent to make future donations without additional board approval?
Yeah.
All right. That'd be helpful if you could do that. We've got a board meeting coming up in 2 weeks and want to make sure we're proper.
Yes. Anywhere where I mentioned you need the board to act, Squire is putting together templates for those. So if anyone finds you need them, just reach out to me and I can send those over. Dan, I've got you on my list.
Thank you. Didn't want to disappoint you by not asking.
Hi, this is Julie Taylor, treasurer at Lancaster City Schools. I had a question about supplementals. If your board decides that they don't want to prorate, rather they want to pay the full supplemental, what do you recommend? Do we take board action on that?
I don't think you need board action if you're just going to continue to pay the supplementals. What I would do is come up with tasks that those individuals can perform from home in order to earn the supplementals so that there's no question about a proper public purpose and services rendered. So, for instance, you know, the baseball coach obviously isn't going to be able to get the team together for practices and games. Perhaps he can do some planning for next season or come up with drills for the students to do in their backyards, that sort of thing. So I would say if your board is going to pay out supplementals, make sure everyone who has not yet performed their full supplemental has something they can do at home to earn that.
Okay. Thank you.
Kim, Dan Wilson again. What's your inside speculation on whether or not the balance of the school year is going to be canceled?
Mr. Wilson, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Yes.
I think Dan, I would be surprised if we have school again this year. I think there's little doubt but that they'll extend it beyond, you know, I guess it's at the end of next week, so be April 6th or 7th. I think that just based on everything you're hearing with respect to what they're expecting, that's going to be extended. And at some point, I will be surprised, and of course I'm frequently surprised in this business, but I would be surprised if school resumes this year, candidly. Most all of the universities, now of course their schedules end earlier. Most of them are done in early May, but all of the universities have gone to total online through the balance of the year, academic year. So I'd be surprised.
Okay. And with that, and I think many of us feel the same way, but you always know more than us. Do you think the closure will continue to expect that the buildings be totally closed and that treasury operations or HR operations still should be done remotely, or will it be a point where some key people can be back to work?
That really is a question around, I think, the stay-at-home order and essential services.
Yes.
I anticipate, and again, you know, these numbers, Dan, fluctuate so quickly, and it's driven by those numbers, by all these different calculations, and there were new numbers that came out today. Having said that, I think, as I said earlier, there's a lot of pressure because of the economic consequences to lift this stay-at-home order in as quickly as possible. And so I think that those functions are likely to open up before what would typically be the end of the school year. And I'd be surprised if it's before the end of April, and would anticipate sometime in May. Now, again, under the governor's order, I think arguably, and I will defer to others on this, but I think arguably under the governor's order, some of those functions you could keep open now if you chose to, as a critical governmental function. But aside from that, I think this order is likely to be eased up long before what would have traditionally been the end of the school year, barring some, you know, outrageous, some numbers that we just haven't seen yet.
And Dan, I'll just say, I agree with Tim that a lot of the functions you mentioned arguably still could be performed now, even performed on site if they had to be. I think the intent is to move as much to remote work as possible. But obviously, there are some things that can't be done remotely, and you still have to keep the schools running.
Yes, Fred Bolden, Soul Schools again. How does that apply to capital projects, roofing repairs, masonry work, those types of activities? Not necessarily school construction, but school repairs and upkeep.
And again, please go ahead, Emily.
Maintaining the physical plant is considered, I think that's actually considered a minimum basic operation in the stay-at-home order. If you have an urgent need, if your roof is leaking, that's something that needs to be taken care of right now. I would say roof repairs are generally pretty urgent, but it is necessarily a case-by-case analysis. It may also come down to whether the vendor is performing the work right now. But there is a lot of discretion in the stay-at-home order, particularly for government entities to decide what is essential to them. And so there is a fair amount of leeway there. You just want to keep in mind that the intent is to minimize the number of people out and about. So if it doesn't have to get done, it doesn't have to get done. But you need a roof, then that needs to happen. That's my take. Tim, I don't know if you agree.
I agree, yes.
So this is Todd Puster from Orange. My question is related to the stimulus bill and specifically the provisions related to our 403B and 457 plans. And it's my understanding that there are some significant amendments in that regard, and also some guidance that suggests that we should consider plan amendments. Have you been able to look at that in sufficient detail to provide any comments?
I have not, and I'm regretting that we don't have Greg Viviani on the call.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Todd. Yeah, I think we need Greg Viviani on the call for that. I agree.
Okay.
He's the world's leading expert on 403Bs. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
Greg could put out some guidance that would help. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll follow up with Greg for you.
Okay.
This is Debbie Cruz from Kent City Schools. is there any indication for the primary election of how voters will be notified of their ability to request an absent ballot? In other words, we're on the ballot for March. Do we need to get our supporters to proactively reach out to the Board of Elections, or will they get some type of a postcard with instructions for a ballot request?
They are under the statute. The Boards of Elections need to send out postcards notifying them that they can print off an absentee ballot application. And there was a lot of discussion around this in this process, because originally they were supposed to be mailed the application itself with a stamped envelope in it to return it. But where they settled on it is Boards of Elections are required to notify. Now, most Boards of Elections don't believe they can get those notices out until the second week of April, which is part of what's causing the angst among these Boards of Elections. I would certainly encourage any school district that has a campaign to actively find your supporters and get them applications. One of the things, they can also call on the phone and make a request, which is something that they're doing, they've not done before. So yes, they will get a postcard, but I would still strongly encourage school districts to reach out to their supporters and make sure that they are submitting applications for an absentee ballot.
Thank you. My second question is for Emily. Could you clarify the one thing that you said we needed to post in our buildings? It was when you were talking about paying employees during the school closure.
Yes. So under the federal legislation that has just passed, the Families First Coronavirus Relief Act, there is a new poster from the Department of Labor that you have to put up with all of your others. That covers the emergency sick leave and emergency FMLA leave provisions. So it's literally just another DOL poster that needs to go up on the wall and on, you know, whatever employee internet you have.
Thank you.
This is Rick. Are there any other questions that anybody has at this time? Of course, please feel free to call us or email us at any time.
Thank you.
Well, again, everyone, thank you so much for your participation. As Rick said, please feel free to email, call any of us anytime. And as I said earlier, there'll be several more developments over the next few weeks, and we will be sure to keep everybody, we'll stay on top of it and communicate as we learn it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone.
Crystal, I believe that concludes our call.
Okay.